On The Murder Squad, we discuss details of crimes that are often violent in nature. Listener discretion is advised.
I'm Billy Jensen.
I'm Paul Holes.
This is The Murder Squad. The boogeyman is a monster every child fears at some point. A creature who comes into your home for no other reason than to harm you. But usually a child outgrows this fear because the boogeyman isn't supposed to be real.
But in Melbourne, Australia, in the late 1980s and early 1990s, an actual monster was entering families' homes. He wore a black ski mask and was usually armed with a knife and gun. After attacking four young girls, he became known as Mr. Cruel. He has never been caught. Our job? To identify Mr. Cruel.
This is The Murder Squad.
All right, Billy, it looks like you're kind of shacked up in a different place.
I am. I am quarantining in New York right now, working on a secret crime project, but because we came from California, have to quarantine for 14 days. So I am in a closet in New York. And if you hear a train in the background, it's because I'm right near a train too. That's all the information you'll get from me.
Yeah. But you're a better man than me. I could not quarantine in a closet for 14 days.
So, I do have a per diem though, which is going straight to alcohol. Anyway. Okay. So, we've had several possibilities for more victims of the Taco Bell strangler, Henry Louis Wallace, sent to us. One that many people, including an officer from the area, sent us is Helen Nikki Anderson. Now, she was murdered in her apartment in Bremerton, Washington in 1986. Nikki and her four-year-old daughter, Adrienne, were strangled. Her infant son was left unharmed. Like many of Wallace's victims, she worked in the fast food industry. She worked at an Arby's. So after hearing our episode, a police officer submitted the case to Bremerton PD, and they are reviewing the case currently. So everybody, good job on that one.
Excellent.
But for now, we're going to cover our first case outside of North America. We're going to go to the suburbs of Melbourne, Australia.
Winter was just coming to a close in Melbourne. At 4 a.m. on August 22nd, 1987, a family was sound asleep in their home in the northeastern Melbourne suburb of Lower Plenty when a man who wore a black balaclava, basically a ski mask, made entry to the home. He was systematic in the way he dealt with his victims. He ordered the parents onto their stomachs, telling them he was just going to take some items from the home. Then he tied them up, using a form of a sailor's knot. He then placed tape over their eyes. Once they were subdued, he locked them in a wardrobe. Next, he concentrated on the six-year-old little boy.
He blindfolded and gagged him. Then he tied him and secured him to his bed. He then trained his focus on his real target at that point, an 11-year-old girl. The offender made her brush her teeth before he began his assault on her. Sometime during the assault, the girl heard and saw him on the phone. He was threatening someone. The girl heard him tell the person on the other end to move their children or they would be next, even adding in name calling. The offender called the person a bozo. At another point in the attack, he stopped to make himself food. When he was done assaulting the young girl, he gave her instructions. He gave her permission to release her parents from the cupboard that they were in, but only after she counted to 100, allowing for his escape. Now, when we look at these details, and because we are who we are, and the case that we met on, this sounded a lot like what was going on in the East Area Rapist, Original Night Stalker cases, at least the East Area Rapist cases. Paul, I'm going to stop right here. Had you heard of Mr. Cruel?
I heard of him right at the end of my career, right when I was retiring, when I believe it was a newspaper article was trying to link the Golden State Killer series to this Mr. Cruel series out in Australia.
Yes. And then what happened was that article came out. It was the last article that talked about GSK, but it was also talking about Mr. Cruel. And then when you caught D'Angelo, a lot of people were misinformed thinking he was Mr. Cruel. Do you remember that?
Yeah, no, I do. You know, and the interesting thing is I remember that article coming out, and we had already identified D'Angelo at that point, and I knew for a fact that GSK was not Mr. Cruel, but I couldn't say anything.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah. So, but let's get back to this, because that was sort of the elephant in the room, though. But, you know, the details aren't provided in the assault. We're not going to go into them anyway. He was methodical, you know, tying up the parents. Obviously, he's choosing the girl in the house. What do you make of this crime scene at this point?
Well, I think, you know, there's so many layers to dissect in terms of how he's approaching. No question, he is showing a level of sophistication, and there is overlap, just like we were talking about, with how D'Angelo would enter into a house and, you know, eliminate the primary threats, the adults. And that's what he does. He gets the adults subdued, bound, and then actually contained within this wardrobe area. And then he goes and takes care of the 6-year-old boy, and he's not showing any sexual interest in the young boy, but he also recognizes that this boy could disrupt his plans. So now he's making sure the boy is taken care of. Then he turns his attention to the girl. And that is obviously what his sexual preference is this 11-year-old girl. And he spends, what, 2 hours with this girl?
Yeah.
Yeah.
And it's also, you know, that you can tell where people would make a connection or a similarity with the East Area Rapist, because the length of time, the food, you know, there were, you know, the tying of the knots. It's a lot of stuff that was similar. If you were to just enter this stuff into sort of a database and say, okay, which criminal did this? There's not that many that would pop up, but we know Eron's would have popped up.
Yeah, you know, there is enough overlap that if this case had been presented to me while I was investigating these Dara Rapist series, I would be eyeballing it very hard, thinking, yeah, there's enough overlap here.
So once law enforcement was called, a few things about the crime scene came into view. The first is that the phone line had been cut, and there was no record of a phone call having been placed from the home phone. But you remember, the 11-year-old girl was sure it was the phone that the offender had used when he called that person the bozo. The second, he had stolen some items from the home. He took a box of classic vinyl records and a blue coat. Again, very similar, you know, taking kind of random things.
Well, even that phone call very much overlaps with D'Angelo, because D'Angelo is all about verbal misdirection, and that's what it sounds like this offender is doing.
The third, he had removed a window pane in the living room to make entry. And the last thing, the amount of time he spent in the house was roughly 2 hours. And that led authorities to believe that he had watched the family before the attack, because it was efficient. I mean, he was able to, you know, get rid of the things that were impeding his main focus very quickly. It seemed like he might have known the whole outlay of the house and everything, very much like D'Angelo as well.
Yeah, it's entirely possible that this offender was inside that house prior to this attack, learning the layout, and then made his plans based on that. You know, so as the story of this crime spread, you know, fear gripped the neighborhood. Everyone wants to believe they can protect their children. Time passed and things got back to normal. But 16 months after the first attack, the boogeyman would emerge just a few miles from the first house he struck. At 5:45 a.m. on December 27th, 1988, John Willis woke up to the feeling of something being pressed against his temple and a voice telling him, "Don't be a hero." When John opened his eyes, a gun was pressed to his head. The man holding the gun was in blue coveralls and a black ski mask. In his other hand, he held a knife. Like the first attack, the intruder incapacitated the parents first, this time tying them up with a copper wire but using the same style of knot. But instead of just tape on their eyes, he gagged them and blindfolded them with surgical tape.
The offender then went through the house. He took $35 from John's bedside table. Again, he cut the phone lines. And again, like in the Lower Plenty home more than a year before, he had a prime target. Despite having four daughters in the home, the offender set himself on one, 10-year-old Sharon. He called her by name when waking her up, careful not to wake the younger sisters that she shared the room with. This time, he blindfolded and gagged his victim, and he had developed even more of a plan than before. He left the house with Sharon, and it would take John roughly 15 minutes to free himself. And upon realizing his daughter was missing and the phone lines were cut, he ran to a neighbor's house to call police. Now, the investigation at this point, different than the other investigation, obviously, because this is now a kidnapping, and it is incredibly active.
This is now, this is where, law enforcement, every single resource needs to be put on to trying to find this girl as fast as possible.
And the idea of recon, there were four young girls in the house. He knew Sharon's name. And, we're talking about Sharon's name because she was named because there was the bulletins that were looking for her. He may have been watching the family, or he may have seen them in the news because they were featured in a local paper due to a house fire 6 months earlier. And Sharon was actually mentioned by name in the article.
Yeah. In these first two cases, you're taking a look at the age of the two girls that he focuses in on, 10 and 11 years old. This is starting to show a little bit of a pattern. And there were four young girls inside this house, and he chose one of them. These types of offenders have very strong preferences for who they want to attack and assault. And so there is something about Sharon, as opposed to the other three girls, that he keyed in on.
18 hours later, just after midnight, a woman walking near Baywater High School stumbled across a little girl dressed in a man's shirt and wrapped in green garbage bags. The girl told the woman, "My name is Sharon Willis, and I was taken from my home early this morning. A man left me here and told me to go and ring home." Sharon shared details of her time in captivity. She was blindfolded the entire time and unable to identify her captor, but she told police her kidnapper was, quote, gentle. He fed and bathed her. He brushed and flossed her teeth. He also clipped her fingernails and toenails. She wasn't sure what happened to her clothes, and she also remembered hearing planes overhead. Paul, what do you make of this behavior?
Well, obviously the cleanup that he's doing on her, and we're not discussing the details of the sexual assault, and that is, so important, like for somebody like me to be able to understand everything that's going on. But obviously we don't want to go into those details. But he is showing a level of evidence awareness, and this is in the late 1980s. DNA was just coming into law enforcement circles, and yet he is taking the time to bathe her. He's brushing and flossing her teeth and clipping her fingernails and toenails. This is not just, he's like trying to beautify a doll. He is trying to get rid of any evidence of himself on and inside of her. That is showing a level of sophistication that is, I would say, on the high end for an offender in the late 1980s.
So the Willis family coped with the trauma of the attack with a number of ways. They actually all stayed in the same room and slept in the same room together. They were, and you can certainly understand why. Yeah. They installed a home security system. A member of the community also gave them a golden retriever to add to their sense of safety. But no one in the community felt safe from the attacker, who at this time was dubbed the Hampton Rapist. And it would be well over a year before the offender would strike again. 18 months after Sharon's kidnapping and sexual assault, another family would be hunted. This time he would choose a house on Monomeath Avenue with two young girls home alone. At 11:30 p.m. on July 3rd, 1990, Brian and Rosemary Linus were still out to dinner. Their two teenage daughters, 15-year-old Fiona and 13-year-old Nikki, were already asleep. The girls were startled awake by a man yelling orders at them. The man armed with a gun and a knife. And he tied up Fiona to her bed. Then he directed Nikki to get her school uniform, which was from the Presbyterian Ladies College, and her sneakers. He told Fiona to tell her dad he needed to pay $25,000 for Nikki's safe return. He then took Nikki and stole the family's own rental car, which was a Holden Berlina, from the house. But again, showing his planning, they barely drove a kilometer before he parked the rental car and transferred Nikki into a different vehicle. So 36 hours after the kidnapping, Brian and Rosemary held a press conference begging for Nikki's safe return and agreeing to pay the ransom. Now, you know, the authorities are linking these together now, and they're knowing. But, you know, in hindsight for us, obviously, is 2020. We're seeing another change in his MO. You know, the parents aren't home. The victim is slightly older, and now he's giving a ransom demand.
Yeah, you know, and I think the parents not being home in this particular case may have been driven because he was dealing with two older teenage girls. And this may be an MO aspect where he isn't sure that he could control these two older girls without having the parents alerted or vice versa. So he is watching this family and he is going in when the parents aren't there. I think there is surveillance going on by this offender.
Yeah. So 50 hours after the abduction, Nikki was discovered. She was fully clothed, wrapped in a blanket, wearing a blindfold, but still alive. She was dropped off at a power station in Kew, which is roughly 5 kilometers from the family's home. And just like with Sharon, she was unable to fully identify the man who kidnapped and raped her. But she was able to provide details of his appearance. This time, the offender made her wash and brush herself, whereas he did these actions for Sharon. Again, he fed her. And according to Nikki, her abductor had seen the press conference, and he even made conversation with Nikki about it. Wow. He repeatedly told Nikki not to peek from the blindfold, telling her, quote, "My freedom is worth more than your life." But Nikki took every opportunity she could. She was able to provide a starting point of what her attacker looked like. She said he was between 30 and 50 years of age, 5'8", a slight pot belly, and had fair, sandy colored hair and eyebrows. Nikki also remembered the details of the house where she was held. The bedroom had beige or cream colored carpet and full length peach curtains. And the double bed had a headboard that matched the curtains. The walls were a light color. The bedside table had a lamp with an orange base and a yellow and white draped shade. And in the middle of the room was a camera on a wooden tripod. On the other side of the room, he had blocked a shelf or bookcase with a blanket. And her captor used a neck brace to keep her still. And she was also able to describe in detail the bathroom. It had a triple-doored shower with a separate bathtub. And the sink was next to the shower. Now, Paul, how important are these details?
Well, you know, those are startling details in terms of the inside of the offender's residence. And, you know, I don't know if these would match any type of motel style rooms that are in Australia. That would be something I would consider, that the offender is not taking her back to his residence. But there's some specific information, such as the color of, you know, the carpeting and the curtains and all that, in which, you know, broadcasting that out to the public could help narrow down, you know, maybe a neighborhood in which, you know, the builders did this style of construction, or, you know, somebody had been inside this house and saw these color curtains. So I think that's huge.
Do you think that would they have had her, and there's nothing in my research that show that they did, but almost do a sketch of the house?
Yeah.
Work with an artist to do a sketch of the house.
Yeah, no.
Or the room, at least.
Absolutely. You know, and that's where when you start as you're going door to door and you're, you know, saying, hey, we're investigating this case. Do you mind? Can we come in, take a look at your place? You know, that type of sketch could help, you know, the investigators that are doing the canvas determine whether or not they're getting into an area that seems to be matching what the victim saw. You know, and I will have to say, though, you know, when I read these details, the thing that really stands out to me is the camera on the tripod.
Yes. And obviously with that, you start to think about pornography. You start to think about how pedophiles would trade this type of material even before the internet. You know, we hear a lot about the internet of people, engaging in that activity and these awful, awful people trading pictures and videos. But back then there was a black market for it, and it did happen.
Well, it most certainly did. And this is where a focus of the investigation should have been taken, and it probably was, because back before the internet, when you had these homemade types of child porn, these individuals had to exchange this with each other. And it generally was disseminated within a very confined geographic region. This guy, and I will tell you, after these the details with the cases that we've talked about so far, this guy is a pedophile. And he has a collection of kiddie porn. And he, prior to these attacks, is probably within that community that is exchanging information. He is known by other guys that have probably been arrested for having kiddie porn. And so now it's like, okay, who would match this guy?
Yeah. So, but those weren't the only details that Nikki could give. Like the victim in Lower Plenty, she remembered hearing the offender talking to someone else, although she never heard anyone reply. The man spoke in an unremarkable Australian accent. He used words like bozo again, but Nikki also said he used some other words, worrywart and missy. His voice wasn't the only similar sound she heard. She also heard airplanes. Hmm. So between the planes that Sharon and Nikki heard, investigators thought they might be able to pinpoint, at least roughly, the house of the attacker. And the flight paths matched for Tula Marine. Law enforcement knocked on over 30,000 doors in the area in hopes to glimpse the house the girls described. Now, when we're dealing with geographic profiling here, it was definitely a different type of geographic profiling than what we were doing with East Area Rapist, where we were looking at the attacks, mapping them, because we certainly had enough of them, and then trying to figure out what was a common denominator with all those attacks. Here, we're going off of the testimony of the survivors and what they remembered, and then trying to pinpoint it from there.
Yeah, you know, and this reminds me, and I can't remember the name of the film, and I'm sure you probably can pull it out of your head. It's a Robert Redford film related to computers and national security, and there was a blind guy that was abducted, or no, Robert Redford was abducted or something, and he was inside a trunk of a car going over this, and he's hearing this repeating pattern, and a blind guy said, oh, that's such and such bridge in the Bay Area, you know, and that's kind of what this is reminding me of, is that this is... You've got these planes, and of course, locals there know where planes are going to be, you know, coming and going. And so that gives at least a focus as to where this guy's residence may be.
Yeah, that movie was The Clearing. And also similar to The Room, too. You remember when the little boy is attempting to escape, and he's remembering, you know, stop signs and type of things before he jumps out of the car.
Yeah.
But every door they knocked on was a dead end. The community was on high alert again. And 9 months later, the man who would become known as Mr. Cruel, so named by a local newspaper because of the way he operated within the homes, he would strike again. And this time would be very different. Thirteen-year-old Carmine Chan regularly watched her two younger sisters, 9-year-old Carly and 7-year-old Karen, while her parents ran the local restaurants they owned in the area. And on the evening of Saturday, April 13th, 1991, it was no different. The three girls were watching TV in Carmine's room. And Carmine and Carly went to the kitchen around 8:40 p.m., but they didn't get a chance to fix a snack, because there was a man in a green-gray tracksuit and a black balaclava waiting for them. He held the knife and told them, "I only want your money. I won't hurt you." He pushed the two younger girls into a closet in the bedroom, and he barricaded the door with the bed. Then he left the house with Carmine. She was only wearing a white short-sleeve nightgown, and she was barefoot. The offender left a message for the Chans on their Toyota Camry, and it said, "Payback, Asian drug dealer, more to come." Now, he's switching it up again now. We're seeing other things that we often see. "I only want your money. I won't hurt you." We saw that with Zodiac. We've seen that before with which he has.
Yeah. And that's minimizing, you know, that's trying to put the victims a little bit more at ease. So they'll be more cooperative, you know, but this misdirection, just like in the previous case where he's, you know, telling the, you know, the one of the girls that is left behind, you know, basically, "I need a ransom." Here, he's trying to push it off on some, you know, payback Asian drug dealer, more to come. You know, this is all to mislead law enforcement because he knows this information is going to get back to the investigators. So the two younger girls were able to get out of the closet and call their parents. Law enforcement brought in dogs, hoping to follow the trail. It led them through the family's garden, tennis courts, and a vacant lot. Then the dogs lost the scent. It is believed the offender had a car waiting on the other side of the vacant lot. The thought was Carmine would be returned alive, just like Sharon and Nikki. But after 3 days, there was no sign of Carmine. Her parents, John and Phyllis, held a press conference asking for her return. Phyllis broke down completely, holding on to Carmine's clothes from earlier in the day of her abduction. The Chans posted letters in the newspaper. Phyllis wrote a letter with a sort of cipher in hopes that Carmine would see it and know they wanted her home. Her sisters also wrote letters. Karen said, "Dear Carmine, I miss you a lot of the time. I'm very scared in the dark, and Mom and Dad miss you very much. And Mimi is sick because she misses you too. Love from Karen." And she decorated the note with hearts and stars.
So like you were saying, you know, each time his efforts to throw investigators off get more elaborate. And each time he is holding the victim longer too.
Yeah. You know, and this is what he is doing is he is progressing to get to his ultimate fantasy. You know, the first time he is attacking the family, but he's sexually assaulting the girl inside the house. And then eventually he is now abducting the girl, but then releasing the girl shortly thereafter. Now he's taken this girl and she hasn't been returned. His ultimate fantasy is now being realized.
So we know the offender discussed Nikki's press conference with her, and one would assume he did the same with Carmine. But despite the family pleading during that press conference and the personal letters in the paper, Carmine was still missing. So the search really started to focus now, not only on Carmine, but finding Mr. Krul. And it became one of the largest manhunts in Australian history. Investigators formed a task force that they called Operation Spectrum. And thousands of man hours by law enforcement and volunteers were put in trying to find Carmine and capture Mr. Krul. But nearly a year later, on April 9th, 1992, a man walking along Eggers Creek near a landfill discovered a human skull. Thomaston police were called, and forensically, they were able to match the remains to Carmine. She had been shot 3 times in the head. So do you think this was his next step?
You know, it's hard to really assess without knowing the fine details of what he is doing to each victim and saying to each victim as he's going through case after case. You know, I think the victimology, and like I say, victimology is huge. You know, the Carmine's mom had said that she likely would have fought against being assaulted. And this could be something that would cause him to have to end up killing her. Maybe she exposed his face as she's fighting back, or he gets frustrated with her. The fact that he shoots her 3 times in the head sounds like an execution. He's trying to eliminate a witness versus a more intimate type of homicide like strangulation.
Right.
So that's kind of the way I'm leading is I think he eliminated Carmine because of he's either frustrated with her due to her fighting back, or she potentially could have identified him based on what she saw. So Australian law enforcement eventually called in the FBI to work with them to create a profile for this offender. The profile they provided said he lived in the vicinity of the attacks. He may work in schools. Nikki and Carmine went to the same school. He is highly intelligent, as seen with his planning. It is believed he probably committed minor crimes before, like stealing underwear or being a peeping Tom. And at one point, they thought he might have been part of law enforcement because of his forensic countermeasures. You know, I actually like that they called in the FBI. In fact, at this point in time, there was an FBI profiler, Kenneth Lanning, who specialized in child molesters. And I was fortunate to sit in a class that Lanning put on at UCLA. And the guy is a stud when it comes to evaluating these types of offenders. So I hope that somebody like Kenneth Lanning was involved in giving information, because then he would have probably imparted some great wisdom to help with the investigation.
Now, I think, you know, it's really important, you know, probably committed minor crimes before, peeping Tom, stealing underwear. We know that's how GSK evolved.
Yeah.
That's, you know, so then what you want to do there is you want to go through anybody that might have had a peeping Tom offense or a, you know, minor theft offense or something along those lines.
Well, that absolutely would be part of any investigative aspect within this case. Now, one of the things about this type of offender, and this is something that is coming out of Lanning, is that, you know, this is a preferential child molester. That this guy is going after basically prepubescent girls. They're right in that 10 to 13 year age range. And this is going to be something that he's been doing for a long time prior to even committing the attacks. He's been fantasizing about them. And one of the things that Lanning writes is that the preferential child molester can be thoroughly investigated and corroborative evidence easily found if investigators understand how to recognize him and how he operates, and if their departments give them the time and resources. Like I said, this guy is in this child porn community, and I believe that that's probably his name is probably within law enforcement files. It's a matter of recognizing that he is the one that is committing these cases, and he is leaving evidence for all the forensic countermeasures he's doing. He's leaving binding material that he brought to the scene. Some of these girls still had their clothes with them when they were found, you know, so there is potential DNA evidence. And I don't know how much Australian authorities have gone after the DNA on some of these items, but it seems like there would be at least potential for evidence that could identify this offender.
Absolutely. You know, taking the, you know, that's a really good thing to point out. It's not just, you know, thinking, is there a rape kit or not? It's the clothes that the girls were wearing when they were returned. Is there any trace DNA on there? Yep. Can you take an MVAC, even all after these years? Were the clothes, kept in an evidence bag and not, you know, recirculated with the kids' other clothes.
Right. And even the,
you hope they were.
And even in Carmine's case, you have, you know, firearms evidence. You know, I'd want to know, okay, what's the make and model of the gun? You know, is there anything unusual about that could provide an investigative lead?
So Carmine's is the last confirmed case traced to Mr. Krule. And he used many of those countermeasures, like we talked about, to minimize that physical evidence. However, law enforcement are sure the same man is responsible for these four crimes. And the certainty comes from his meticulous MO and the victim statements and descriptions. But these aren't believed to be his only victims. You know, there was a case in 1985 of an abduction and rape of a 14-year-old girl from her Hampton home. And the attacker took her to a vacant lot, blindfolded, bound and gagged. And a few hours later, he dropped her off at the Moorabbin Bowl. Victorian police also believe he's responsible for at least 12 other cases of crimes committed against children in a 10-year period surrounding the known attacks. And we're going to talk about possible suspects in just a minute. But first, do we think an offender like this would just stop abducting or raping or murdering? Again, this is a question that we had a lot when it was coming to GSK.
I've formed the opinion after really taking a look at this phenomenon, you know, because when I first got involved in looking at serial predator cases, of course, the mantra was, is that once they start, they never stop. However, we've seen examples of offenders who have committed many crimes in a single series stop. I think it is individual to the offender. And what his motivations are, what his life circumstances are, I think this particular offender is going to be somebody that has a desire to continue, but his last known attack ends in a homicide. The only homicide that is attributed to him at this point. Did whatever happened with Carmine scare him to where now he's scared he's going to get caught? And does he have enough self-control to prevent going out and attacking again? That's possible. Or has he moved on, or has he died? Like we always say, well, if we have no other crimes attributed to the offender, he's either in custody, disabled, or dead. That's not necessarily the case. And we see that with D'Angelo. And, you know, this offender could still be living within that very community. So the task force had created a dossier known as the Sierra Files. Inside were a list of 7 possible suspects. The Herald Sun was granted access to the files and discussed some of the suspects, of which reporters tried to trace. The first was Brian Elkner. He actually gave an interview to a news program saying he knew he was the prime suspect. Elkner is a convicted violent serial sexual offender. He also had an essay published in 1973 in the book Studies in the 18th Century. In the essay, he said one should do evil in order to become a hero.
So Elkner said he turned his life around when he was interviewed in 2016, and as of today, he hasn't been charged. The other suspect the Herald Sun was able to trace from the files is Robert Keith Knight. Knight was a school volunteer and youth worker, and in 1980 and 1996, he was convicted of sexual assaults on a minor. After the news of the 96 attack, other victims also came forward, and he was released from prison in 2009. After being released, he collected child pornography. His collection was extensive, and he was rearrested. And while awaiting that trial, he died by suicide by jumping from a second-story prison railing. Now, we've got these two suspects here, Brian Elkner, a guy that says he turned his life around, which, you know, if somebody would have interviewed D'Angelo, he very well could have said that. That's sort of been his thing, that he splits his life up into two different.
Right.
This other guy, Robert Keith Knight, looks very good as well. What do you think about both of these suspects?
Well, you know, with Elkner, fundamentally, he's a sex offender. And his name probably came up during the investigation because he was, you know, a registered sex offender in the jurisdiction. I would want to know more about his prior offenses to see how much overlap in behavior there is with the cases attributed to this series. Now, Knight is interesting, you know, because here, I believe that this offender is this preferential child molester type of offender, and these individuals often are in a position to where they have access to children. And Knight was a volunteer at a school and a youth worker, and he's also been convicted of sexual assaults on a minor. So he has sort of that background that I would expect. And then, as I pointed out from Special Agent Lanning's expertise, these guys that are interested in kids, they are collectors of child porn. That's almost, if they're a preferential child molester, they almost always have something. And Knight has a collection of child pornography. But I would also expect that there would be evidence of Knight's involvement with these cases, that if they searched hard enough, they would have found that. And as of right now, they haven't linked him conclusively to this series.
Yeah, I mean, when you first heard of Mr. Cruel, like we were talking about, it was right before D'Angelo was arrested, right around the time that you were that you were retiring. You know, the interesting thing about this case, different from GSK, actually kind of similar to GSK in a sense, where you have the Herald Sun able to look through all of the old files. Now, you know, we know Michelle, when she was writing I'll Be Gone in the Dark, was able to look through a lot of files. I don't know if she was ever able to look through all of them. Were there any files that she really wanted to see that had potential suspects in them that were not given to her?
You know, she ended up receiving files that came out of Orange County Sheriff's Office. Yeah. And I'm aware of some of what she obtained because she shared those with me. It was files that I had never seen, even though I'd been involved in the case for several decades at that point. But I don't know everything that she had access to. But I do believe she probably did have access to some information that was listing suspects because she was hitting me up about, hey, what about this guy or what about that guy?
Yeah. And that's one of the things that, listen, and at the end of the day, GSK got caught. I like the fact that the police gave the files. They sort of threw up their hands at one point and said, you know what? Let's try something new. Let's see if the journalist can figure it out. And they're so, I just wish that would happen more in America where, you know, you contact law enforcement for a murder that happened 25 years ago and they won't give you anything because it might affect the investigation. And it's like, guys, you're not working on the investigation right now. Just give it all up and let's see if we can solve this together.
Yeah. You know, and most certainly that's sort of what the murder squad is all about, is trying to empower, you know, the civilians out there to help law enforcement. You know, I just know from my perspective, as even with an old case, there's certain laws about what you can and can't release, you know, out into the public domain. And so there would have to be heavy redaction, or that law enforcement officer could potentially lose their job. It's one of those catch-22s because of those types of laws.
Yeah. No, I mean, I think the redaction is important, and the redaction would be mainly for privacy and civil rights of
absolutely
suspects that were in there and that sort
yep.
of thing.
Yep.
But you know what? Pay some redactors to go redacting. You know, it's all right. So that brings us to our weekly assignment. You know, Mr. Krule has never been caught. And there are three confirmed cases with sexual assault survivors, as well as the murder of Carmine Chan. Law enforcement believes he may have had many other sexual assault victims and possible murder victims. Each victim deserves justice. Remember that description of the house, the description of him. And if you have any theories or information on Mr. Krule, please contact us. And also, if you believe you're a survivor of Mr. Krule, contact us as well. So, and this is a case that people have asked us about many times, and we wanted to do it because when you're looking at a case outside of America, we know we have a lot of listeners in Australia, but you know, I think this is one case where a lot of people in America knew about it as well. And obviously, it's a guy that really needs to get caught.
You know, and one of the things that's popping into my head is, if he is taking pictures of these girls and he is involved with child porn, you know, buying, trading child porn, even though at the time that he is doing this, I mean, this is hard copy, VHS tapes or color prints, you know, of photos. At this point in time, some of those images of his victims could have been digitized. And I'm wondering if they've ever explored, because there is a massive, you know, child porn database that, you know, you can search to see if the same image is showing up in different areas.
Yeah.
I wonder if there is something, if anybody has explored that aspect, you know, even with facial recognition from these girls.
Yeah. You know, the National Center for Missing and Exploited Children, they have a whole team that works on that. And so does the FBI. And it's, you know, it's a job that is so important, but it's also, you know, fraught with so much, you have to look at these awful images. But what you're doing is you're looking at anybody that might be identifiable. And then also the backgrounds of places. Where exactly is this happening?
Yeah.
And I think that's a really good point. I'm going to give my contacts at NCMEC a call to see if they've heard about this one and see if it's on their radar.
Yeah. And we don't know. Obviously, we have descriptions of, you know, what his wherever he was taking his victims possibly look like. But we don't have, you know, an image of that. But what we do have is we have what those girls look like at the time of their abduction, basically.
Yeah. Okay, so, you know the rules. Don't name names in public. Be nice. Don't dox each other. And now we get to the weekly distraction. I'm going to go first because I flew on an airplane for the first time since the pandemic started. And it was an enjoyable experience, except for there was no food or alcohol on the flight. So it was, but let me tell you something, no middle seat, nobody in the middle seat, which is great.
Yeah, no, that's nice. I've flown a couple of times, having to go back to Sacramento. Unfortunately, didn't have the no middle seat. It was a full plane each time that I flew. But what was surprising to me was, you know, the Denver airport, which is, you know, kind of a central hub in the United States, was just as busy as ever. But when I landed in SAC the first time for the plea hearing for D'Angelo, it was like a ghost town. And you know, the Sacramento airport is usually bumping pretty good. You know, so it was just interesting, the contrast and how crowded Denver airport was relative to Sacramento.
Sacramento airport, that's the one that has the giant rabbit.
Yes, it was. In fact,
I love that.
I actually flew back from Hawaii. My wife and I had gone out to visit my parents who live in Hawaii, and we were the first airplane to land at that new Sacramento terminal where that rabbit is. So I can say that I was one of the first passengers to ride down the escalator and have that red rabbit go over my head.
That's great. What's your distraction?
Yeah, you know, I'm really struggling because it right now, you know, I've got so many things going on as I've been posting online with animals in my backyard, whether it be bears or deer or anything else. I think my distraction right now is just the craziness of the weather. You know, I literally was in 90 plus degree temperatures in Colorado one day. And then overnight, we got snow. And I'm looking out my office right now, and though some of it has melted, you know, I have snow on the ground, and it's early September. So, you know, what the hell's going on? That's crazy.
All right. So, thank you, everybody, for joining us. Remember, you can sign up for Stitcher Premium, and we've got 10 episodes that you can just binge right there. There's a lot of fun stuff. We talked to Affirmative Murder, Scam Goddess, True Crime Garage, James Renner. A lot of fun stuff. Pick up some merch, subscribe, join us on social. There's a lot of fun things going on in the Facebook group. And until next week,
keep digging.
And don't be an irony.
Jensen and Holes, The Murder Squad, is produced by Exactly Right Media and Bench Clearing Productions. Senior producer, Pauly Katowski. Engineer, Stephen Ray Morris. Music, Tom Breifogel. Executive producers, Karen Kilgariff, Georgia Hardstark, Danielle Kramer.